I'm Tammy Haddad, and this is Washington Insider. Thank you for joining us. We're talking with George Condon, the White House correspondent for National Journal and the former Washington bureau chief for Copley News Service and the San Diego Union-Tribune. George has interviewed 8 presidents, won a Pulitzer Prize, and he served as president of the Gridiron Club and as chairman of the National Press Foundation. He's now the unofficial historian of the White House Correspondents Association. George told me that when he was elected president of the association in 1993, he couldn't believe the Correspondents Association hadn't kept any records. So like any good journalist, George started digging.
Correspondents Association started because of press conferences. Woodrow Wilson basically invented the press conference. Teddy Roosevelt would have reporters in while he was shaving in the morning, but it wasn't a press conference. Woodrow Wilson started press conferences, so the question became, who can attend a press conference? And the most powerful group of journalists in Washington at that time was the Standing Committee of Correspondents. And they, up on Capitol Hill, said, we'll tell you who goes to White House press conferences. And White House reporters were not about to let congressional reporters tell them who could go. So they said, no, we'll take care of it. And the whole point was to try to keep out what they called tipsters.
Tipsters?
People who worked for brokerage firms and would go to these press conferences, which were, you couldn't quote the president. And they would come out and send things to brokerage firms, and it would affect the stock market. People were making thousands of dollars off of this. So they had to keep the tipsters out. And there was a problem in 1913 with people quoting from a Wilson press conference. So the Standing Committee moved in again, sent a letter to the president saying, we'll do it, we'll do it. And to get away from that, the Correspondents Association was formed in February of 1914. And they saw the president a lot more than we see the president today. It was a much more casual relationship. The press have been inside the White House since McKinley, despite you hear this myth that Teddy Roosevelt invited them in on a snowy day. Totally not true. In fact, the job of White House correspondent was sort of invented by William Price of the Washington Star, who was the first president of the White House Correspondents Association.
What do you mean, the job?
Before Price came to town, all the coverage was done from Congress. If somebody met the president, you would wait till they got back to Capitol Hill and then you would interview them there. William Price came to town, and I think it was 1890s, and he asked for a job at the Washington Star. To get rid of him, they said, go to the White House, see if you can get anything.
Wasn't a good job.
And no, but he did what he had done in South Carolina, where he reported by standing at the train station, and he'd interview people when they came to town or left town. So he did the same thing. He went to the White House, went to the North Portico, and he just stood there. And when somebody came out after interviewing the president or meeting the president, he would just casually say to him, well, so how did it go? And people then as now are excited when they see a president, and they want to talk about it.
Now, did the White House staff try to stop that? I mean,
no,
who would want to
no.
They loved it? They thought it
no.
helped them?
And there were the daily briefings started under McKinley. In fact, I just love this. I would challenge 100 people to guess what time the daily briefing was. His name was Porter, the secretary to McKinley. 10:30 p.m.
Why?
He would tell people how the day went and look to the next day. So the reporters worked 7-day weeks and very long hours, interspersed with a lot of time at restaurants and bars, I'm sure.
Oh, that's what I was going to ask you. A lot of drinking going on then?
Yeah.
With the president. Presidents like to drink with reporters.
Well, I mean, each president is different on that. Harding would certainly play poker with them and drink. Every president was different on that. Harry Truman, he was to go to Florida for his Florida White House, they called it. And he waited one time at the foot of the plane for the press plane to arrive and had a reporter's notebook and tried to interview the president of the White House Correspondents Association. So he would clown around with them.
So it was all we're in this together. Even during wars, you know,
well,
we're part of the same team?
No. That's never. Presidents have always had an adversarial relationship. I mean, Teddy Roosevelt co-opted reporters something terribly, but if you crossed him, he had what he called his Ananias Club, and you were frozen out. Grover Cleveland never forgave the reporters for the way they covered his honeymoon when he married a 21-year-old as president. Wilson hated the coverage of his family, you know, who his daughters were dating, and then his wife died and he was dating who became his next wife. He just hated the coverage of that, and part of that was because he had spent time at Princeton with Grover Cleveland telling him how much to hate reporters. So
do you think all presidents tell each other these guys are not on your side, or do you think they do that?
Oh, no, they don't need anyone else to tell them. By the time they reach the presidency, they know that it's adversarial.
We see presidents publicly now with correspondents going in and out at a press briefing. It feels like there's a comfortable relationship there. Is that all for the cameras?
No, but every president has a different relationship. Bill Clinton knew all of our names. He knew things about you. I mean, in my case, I had first interviewed Bill Clinton when we were both students at Georgetown. So I had interviewed him for the Hoya.
And he remembered that?
Well, that's the remarkable thing about Bill Clinton. He was a big deal on campus. I was a nobody freshman reporter for the Hoya. And he was head of the Student Athletic Commission. And he was doing a football promotion. Yes, Georgetown has football. Not big-time football, but they have it. And Bill Clinton had to show that we had once had big-time football, had brought back on campus members of the Georgetown football team that had played in the Orange Bowl in 1941. I did a three-paragraph story in the Hoya. I saw Bill Clinton 8 or 9 years later covering a governor's conference. He remembered my name. Absolutely unbelievable.
And when he was governor, did you think he'll be president someday?
You thought it would be a difficult road for a governor of Arkansas to do that, but you tended not to put anything past him. You knew he was ambitious. He certainly was smart. And I was very big on covering national governors' conferences, and he was such a leader of the NGA that it was very believable.
George, tell us what it's like. You are in the lower press room at the White House. Can you tell us what it's like working there as a White House correspondent?
Well, the basement's the power.
Oh.
you have the big networks up on the first level above the swimming pool. We're down on the level of the swimming pool. And anybody who runs for office in the White House Correspondents Association, they have to win the basement. We're the Ohio of the White House Correspondents Association.
The road to the presidency of the White House Correspondents Association, through the basement.
You're jammed in very tight among the National Journal. You have political, you have real clear politics. You have Yahoo News, McClatchy, Washington Examiner. And then you have the booths for all the radio people. And you have the booth for Fox and CNN. And it's a good group. You have to like each other because you're in so tight. And you have certain things that you have to overcome. I attended a mouse summit at the GSA because we have such a mouse problem down there. You know,
right, no rats, just mice.
Ed Henry of Fox was complaining when a mouse ran across his script as he was reading it, or the food that you might leave out goes. Plus, you have frequent flooding whenever it rains, and that a little disconcerting because of the smell, but also the day that I was working and my power strip is on the floor, and I realized that my feet were in about 2 inches of water, and the power strip was right next to it. But my favorite thing is White Houses always blame an earlier president for the problems. You know, it's all George W. Bush's problems. At one point, the worker blamed Thomas Jefferson for this, that he had done something to the White House that caused this flooding. I thought that was going a little far back.
Well, that's history. That's a National Geographic special right there.
They really got a full house today, huh? Julie Pace.
Thank you, Mr. President. I wanted to ask about Cuba. what would you say to dissidents?
George, what about the evolution of the White House correspondent? You've got bloggers there from YouTube and other places. How's that changed your life?
You're not suggesting it's changed from the 1950s, are you?
No, I'm not at all, actually.
No, well, the immediacy is the main thing that's changed. When Jerry Warren would do briefings during the Nixon years, he would then go back to his office and look at the what the AP and UPI wires said, and there was nothing that he really had to do. Some reporters might come up just before the nightly newscast. He had to deal with three networks. As recently as Jimmy Carter, there was no McLaughlin Group. There was no CNN, Fox. There was no MSNBC. So you just have a lot more people doing, and some of them have green lipstick.
Are the White House correspondents jealous when, you know, who comes to the door in the morning but these part-time bloggers?
You know, when Bill Clinton came into the White House, Vanity Fair wrote a story about how all these new White House reporters were going to take over. They had traveled with Clinton, and they had one paragraph in which they described the quote-unquote mastodons of the White House press corps who were running the Correspondents Association at the time, and they named Carl Lubsdorf, Susan Page, and me as among the mastodons. And I would just point out
the Pulitzer Prize-winning mastodons.
Yes, that we're still here, and none of the other ones who were listed in that story as going to revolutionize White House coverage are still covering the White House. Now, that doesn't make it good, but the fact is, White Houses always experiment with new things. This president gives interviews to Facebook and Vox and all these other things. But when they want some attention paid to their policies, you still go back. They can't get away from the wires, the networks, the New York Times, the Washington Post.
And is the New York Times still the top of the food chain for White Houses?
Well, I think Washington Post also is there. I mean, the New York Times.
When a New York Times reporter walks in the room, in my experience, the room changes. Is that true?
Well, the fact is the New York Times has one of the nicest, best reporters on the beat right now in Peter Baker. So he would be embarrassed to think that if he entered the room, it changed because
right,
he's such a nice guy.
This is purely a political comment, right? That's right. How they look at it. Maybe this White House doesn't. Tell me if I'm wrong.
Well, no, I mean, we know the New York Times has the clout that most of us don't. So are they going to be treated differently by a White House? Yes, absolutely.
Working in the basement of the White House may not be so glamorous, but one of the perks of being a White House correspondent is getting a ticket to the association's annual dinner. Although these days, one of those golden tickets will more than likely end up in the hands of a celebrity guest or advertiser. There are some critics that say the dinner is too focused on glitz, but George says stars have always come to the dinner, dating back to the roaring 20s when vaudeville and silent movie stars came to Washington to schmooze with the president.
The biggest myth about the dinner that you hear over and over again is that, oh, it's gone Hollywood. Oh, this is terrible. Yes, TV is showing that. But the dinner was much more Hollywood in its early years, much more, even before there was something called Hollywood.
So the stars wanted to be with the president.
Oh, yes, that's always it. They don't want to be with the reporters, for God's sake. But the golden years of the entertainment at the Correspondents' Dinner was 1931 to 1945, because you had the radio networks started in 26, 27. Then they decided we're going to use the Correspondents' Dinner to showcase our biggest stars in front of the president. So from 1931 to 1945, CBS and NBC Paramount alternated years providing their biggest names. And you would have an hour and a half show. There was always opera singers. There were comedians. There were balloon acts. There were jugglers. A magician who took FDR's wallet.
Today, where it's just one comedian and the president speaks.
No, they went to the single comedian in 83 because the dinner was in such terrible straits the entertainment was terrible. Because after the entertainment stopped in 45 with the radio broadcasters, then you had ASCAP provided the entertainment for a while. But by the time you got into LBJ, the Nixon years, it was pretty horrendous. 1975, Helen Thomas was the first woman president of the association. So the whole theme of the night was "Woman, Hear Me Roar, We've Made It." So somebody got the bright idea, we have a Lebanese named Thomas as president, let's have a Lebanese named Thomas as the comedian. So they brought in Danny Thomas, who got up there after hearing all these speeches about women, we've made it. And he did his basic Las Vegas lounge act with the theme of, women, they don't have brains, but boy, you know, they're nice to look at.
Did that go over with the crowd?
Well, you've been to these centers. You know this is not an easy crowd.
Right.
And they were booing, they were hissing, and he kept making it worse about what a bad driver his wife was, and I love my wife. And then he tried to react to the booing and the hissing by saying, now, come on, I have you girls up on a pedestal. And it was just an absolute disaster. And his daughter, Marlo Thomas, who was a feminist, was there. And she was in the position afterwards that, you know, everybody's been in the position where you love your parents, but you know they've just really
embarrassed you.
She was trying to get him away from reporters who were asking him about the booing and the hissing. And
what did Helen Thomas do?
Well, she later denied, she almost denied that she was there. When I talked to her, she said, I had nothing to do with it. Nothing to do with it. It was terrible.
Tell us about the first dinner.
It was an effort in 1921 to sort of recreate the fun that the reporters had had in Marion, Ohio at dinners with Warren Harding when he was running for president. And so he threw a dinner for the reporters when he first came in, and then they decided to throw a dinner. So 50 people gathered at the Old Arlington Hotel, and the president didn't come to that one, but it set the standard. They had some music, a local guy, George O'Connor, singing songs. And
so it was just the correspondents schmoozing with each other. Were there other government officials
there? Yeah, all the top White House staff. Now, White House staffs were very small in those days. Mm-hmm. There's only 50 people.
So when did the president start attending?
Harding died, and Coolidge came in. And in 1924, his first year that they had a dinner after he came into the presidency, they went to the Hamilton Hotel, which later became a real dive on 14th Street. It was then one of the fanciest hotels in town. And Coolidge came to the dinner, and he gave the most god-awful, boring, tedious, long speech on the importance of separation of powers. What is the role of Congress? What is the role of the president? And not coincidentally, after that speech, they told presidents, you don't have to give a speech.
Oh.
No speech by the president at these dinners. And that actually became a something that presidents loved. FDR and the other presidents loved the fact that they could go to this dinner and just enjoy themselves.
My fellow Americans, mahalo.
Your top priority is getting the President of the United States to attend.
This is not guaranteed that he's going to come.
No. In fact, Richard Nixon skipped several. They canceled the dinner in 65 because LBJ wasn't going to attend. They canceled a couple of dinners because Eisenhower wasn't going to attend. They decided after 65, we're not going to cancel it just because the president doesn't come. So you would have other people filling in. 1 year, Pat Nixon filled in. 1 year, Chief Justice Burger. Jimmy Carter so despised the dinner.
Why bother? You're president.
Oh, he didn't like anything about the reporters.
I've had a lot of setbacks, a lot of troubles, as you know. And you've been kind enough to make those clear. To the American people, which is legitimate and expected, and I don't have any reason to think that objecting to it would help.
He didn't like the fact when a president goes somewhere, a pool of reporters follows him. And he was always sneaking out to go to Kennedy Center. Oh, Jimmy Carter was a disaster for press coverage. He left and went to a state park in Pennsylvania once. And so the Correspondents Association sat down, met with him, and it was a very testy meeting where he told them, if Rosalind and I want to go look for arrowheads in the park, we don't want reporters with us. So that was a constant fight. And he said in his diary, you know, they want me to go. They beat me up all the time. They want me to go to the dinner just to make some jokes for their entertainment. I'm not doing it.
When were women allowed into the dinner?
Well, women were always members and always attended the press conferences. They didn't have the discrimination that blacks had. They paid full dues, which up to this point was $2 a year to be members, but they couldn't attend the main event because, as Merriman Smith, the famous UPI reporter, said, the dinner's too bawdy for women, which is ridiculous because there's nothing in its history to suggest it's ever been bawdy.
That's the Gridiron Theater, your other dinner.
John F. Kennedy is elected president. He attends the dinner in 61.
I want to express my thanks to the White House press correspondents for their hospitality and having me to dinner. I want you to know that we hope that you will all come to the White House. We have the best Filipino chef over there that you can find in Washington.
After the dinner, several reporters complained to Pierre Salinger. One reporter met with this Pierre Salinger's mother to complain, and she pointed out that that's not how it was in France. And President Kennedy, to his credit, told the association, I'm not going to the dinner next year if women aren't allowed to come.
And what about blacks?
Well, blacks had been kept out of the press conferences.
And that was a White House decision?
No, that was a correspondent. In fact, President Roosevelt wanted the black reporters to be permitted, and the Correspondents Association would not allow it. And finally, in 1944, FDR overruled the Correspondents Association and ordered that Harry McAlpin be allowed to attend, and the Correspondents Association there wouldn't even introduce him, and FDR went out of his way to welcome him there. And to punish him, they never let McAlpin be a member. And we made up for that last year, or tried to atone for it. I tracked down Harry McAlpin's son, who lives in Bowie, Maryland, and we invited them to dinner, introduced the son to President Obama, and I sat next to Harry McAlpin, his wife and daughter, for the dinner. And my favorite moment of the dinner was when we had him stand and people recognized him. And we gave an honorary membership to his father to make up for the racism of the past.
What was the most important dinner?
There's no question. It was the March of 1941. The day before the dinner, President Roosevelt asked permission from the Correspondents Association to address the nation from the dinner on a live radio broadcast. And the correspondents didn't quite know what to do. They had their whole show planned. They had a fake movie. They had jugglers. They had comedians. And here, he wanted to make them work. But of course, they said yes. They did gags up until the moment he went live. And then he did this live, extraordinarily somber speech, which basically said to the world, we're going to be in this war. You know, we're going to have a lot of casualties. To the democracies of the world, hang in there. America's going to come and help you.
We believe that the rallying cry of the dictators, their boasting about a master race, will prove to be pure stuff and nonsense. There never has been, there isn't now, and there never will be any race of people on the earth fit to serve as masters over their fellow men.
And they went immediately to a comedian named Flip and a gag movie. So it was jarring, but it was easily the most important moment.
So when did the dinner get so large?
Well, it started with 50 people. It took 30 years to get up to 1,000 people. Then it took another 30 years to get to 2,000 people when Reagan was president. The dinner just got more popular. Reagan liked the dinner, as opposed to presidents who had come before him.
I've been criticized for going over the heads of Congress. So what's the fuss? A lot of things go over their heads.
The 93 dinner, we sold out for the first time.
I want to complain about something. This is my night. You all complain to me all the time. I watched CNN the other night, one of these 100-day stories, and I couldn't believe it. There were Andrea Mitchell, Susan Spencer, Brett Hume, and Wolf Blitzer on Larry King Live. Imagine that, going around the president to take their message directly to the American people.
And in that ballroom at the Washington Hilton, you're talking about 2,500 to 2,600 people. And we moved the Marine Band. We've jammed everything we could in there. And that was also the first dinner I helped push to open it to TV, over the objection, I should say, of the TV networks. They did not want it open to TV.
Why?
Because they didn't want to have to work the night of the dinner. They enjoyed just going. It wasn't viewed as particularly newsworthy. And there was also... there was a union issue, so we had to work that out. But we refused to let more than one camera in because we didn't want to give up any tables.
Let's talk about what it's like to sit in the room.
Members can invite anybody they want. And you encourage them to invite news sources. So you do have a lot of members of Congress, basically everybody in the cabinet. I never went for big names. My guess.
Why?
I wanted people who helped me on stories.
You're the only one, George, may I point
out. No,
Everyone else is chasing down the big names.
No. And I think that the people at that level appreciate the invitation.
So you say you try to entice the president to come or get a president to come. I mean, how do you do that? What could you possibly offer them? You're obviously not offering them special coverage,
no,
right?
No. But I mean, this is another myth about the dinner. Is that, and you see this all the time now in defense of Stephen Colbert, is that, well, the point of the dinner is to roast the president. No, it's not. It's never been to roast the president. Gridiron does that. The Correspondents Association is supposed to honor the president. That was always the purpose of it.
But if it's to honor the president, why some comedians like Joel McHale was there last year? I mean, if you spend any time in, you know, show business or in the television world, you know his whole persona is to be cynical and make fun of the president, TV, comedy.
The president is not immune from it. He's going to come in for... my comedian in my year was Al Franken. Mm-hmm. And we talked a lot before the dinner about, you know, I know you're a Democrat, but you've got to make fun of the president, too. You've got to, you know, make fun of both parties. It does not work if you are partisan.
If I say a joke that's a little offensive, if I say something completely out of line, if I make a total jerk out of myself, I will simply apologize and then move on. I mean, it seems to have worked for Alan Simpson.
Bob Hope at the 45 dinner was the first one I saw that talked about this, in that you understand that every joke you tell, people are going to look at the president to see if he's laughing before they laugh. If you're watching Stephen Colbert in 2006 on YouTube or MSNBC, that factor isn't there.
Right.
All you know is you hate George Bush, and here's somebody voicing your partisan views. If you're in that room, and the president of the United States is your guest, yes. If somebody is making him extraordinarily uncomfortable, you're going to be uncomfortable too.
Can you describe that year?
Well, it was 2006. George Bush was president. The Iraq War was very much a matter of controversy. It wasn't going well. And Mark Smith, the president of the Correspondents Association, had seen, despite people keep saying he had never seen Stephen Colbert, he had seen him, admired him, thought he was funny, bring him in. Stephen Colbert was very pointed in going after the president and going after the press for not asking the tough questions about the war, and basically for Bush suggesting that he was pretty dumb and dense and uncaring. And Bush was not amused. Until you're actually up there 4 feet away from the president, you can intellectually understand it, but you don't quite grasp it. Now, Colbert did drop some things that he had planned to say. He senses the audience. I don't blame Stephen Colbert for what he did. He was in an impossible situation. But the mistake was Stephen Colbert had to do his bit in his faux character, as the faux blowhard, Bill O'Reilly type character. That doesn't allow you to make fun of both sides. If you had Stephen Colbert now that he's going to be on CBS, he doesn't have to stay in character.
Now, did the White House complain to the White House Correspondents Association
No.
after that?
No.
How do you know President Bush didn't like it? By his face?
I know. Well, I said the White House didn't complain. Karl Rove was yelling and cursing that night as we were leaving. I mean, they were voicing it. And you don't have to be a rocket scientist to know what the look on the president's face meant.
So they come in, you pick the comedian. What kind of advice do you give them in advance? Do you have writers that help them? Do their writers write it? And do you have people work with them on the material?
Well, each comedian is different. Al Franken used to call me up almost every day. His goal was to write one joke a day. And he would call me and bounce them off me. And I knew half of them he'd never used. They were inappropriate, but they were hilarious. The advice we give them is don't go blue. Do not get up there and swear. And that has not happened at our dinner. We keep getting blamed for people that went to the radio TV dinner because they had the bad judgment of having Don Imus 1 year. And we keep getting blamed for him. He was not at the Correspondents' Dinner.
All right. We'll straighten that out on this podcast.
Okay.
But it's actually interesting you brought that up because as a TV person, you know, for many years, that was the bigger dinner. That's where guests, you know, we, the TV bookers, started bringing in some big names. And then some way, I think, with all due respect to the White House Correspondents, part of it was because the weekend and more people were available, all the stars started to come to the White House Correspondents Dinner Saturday night. And, you know, we should address that because many people in town criticize the fact that there are so many celebrities there. Do you think that's a problem?
No, not in the slightest. I am embarrassed by the red carpet. I wish we didn't have that.
Why?
It's just not what reporters should be doing. I have no problem at all with some mix of the 2,600 people being big names. It's a smaller percentage now than it was in the 30s and the 40s. When you have 800 people total at the dinner and more than 100 of them were entertainers, and they didn't all schmooze at the dinner. They would go to a party after the dinner and all drink and carouse. The New York Times, which is up on its high horse, oh, we can't go to the dinner because we don't do these things.
And when did that start?
They were there through the early Bush years because they got embarrassed. Sheryl Crow and Karl Rove got into a shouting match.
And Laurie David.
The
I was right there.
Right, and Laurie David. And I think Karl Rove had been the New York Times guest, but they didn't write about that. The Washington Post, I think, was the first one that wrote about it. And the Times was embarrassed, and it was after that year they stopped going. They didn't cite that, of course. But they said, oh, this is beneath us. This is the same news organization that doesn't have any problem at all with their columnists having private dinners with White House staff or the president or senators. But they say it's unseemly to have a dinner with the president, with newsmakers. And then it was the New York Times people that I remember complaining to me in the 80s about how incredibly boring the dinner was. And it had gotten pretty boring. And now they're complaining that it's too not unboring?
You know, Tom Brokaw has quite publicly attacked the dinner as way over the top now and way too much. Talk about how people decide who the celebrities are brought in and what role the Correspondents Association has with it, or if they do.
Well, first let me say that there's nobody who is a bigger admirer of Tom Brokaw than me. But on this, I disagree with him. He's nostalgic for the worst years of the dinner, the most boring, horrendous dinners were the years when he was covering the White House. So I'm not nostalgic for the bad dinners, the ones that bored you to tears.
Are you inviting him as your guest this year for the correspondence dinner?
I would love to be around Tom Brokaw at any time. I could learn a lot from him. But
okay,
no,
Tom.
I think he said he's not going to the dinner. And I've never used any of my invitations for celebrities. I use them for people that I work with and that can help on stories. And I'm quite happy doing it that way. In my year, the red carpet consisted of my two young nephews in the lobby hoping to see Evander Holyfield, the heavyweight champion, when he came in. That was the red carpet.
Right, but that actually brings up the point. The issue of the red carpet is the fact that so many people in Washington and the White House correspondents and people in Washington that are going to the dinner, they want to see the celebrities. So by the White House Correspondents Association makes a decision that they don't want to make it a formal red carpet or have a separate room where people could meet and greet. So part of this sort of bubbles up because no one is taking control of the event. And I can tell you from meetings I've had with the White House Correspondents Association, it's for a really good reason. And that is that the White House correspondents don't want to look like they're profiting from the presidency or from the dinner, right? Because then you look like you're the Oscars or you're the Emmys and you're promoting yourselves. Is that true?
Well, I think there is a sizable segment of our membership who Tom Brokaw speaks for. The dinner isn't supposed to be about celebrities, and when you do anything to encourage that, you're making it more about celebrities.
So why don't you ban them?
As I said, I like having some there. It was a pretty boring dinner.
What's in it for the celebrities? What are they doing there?
They're there because of the President of the United States. And, you know, when everybody told me, oh, we hate the celebrities, we got to do away with that, I told them there was a very easy answer for that. Vote for Mitt Romney. If Barack Obama is not president, if Mitt Romney was president, I guarantee you wouldn't have the Hollywood contingent.
Wait a minute. Ozzy Osbourne, you got to tell the story. Ozzy Osbourne was there. President Bush wins. It's after the recount, and it's very uncomfortable for President Bush and everyone else in politics. Things hadn't settled down yet. Comes along the White House correspondents' dinner, and Ozzy Osbourne is Greta Van Susteren's guest. Talk about that dinner.
Well, one of President Bush's best lines in his speech was a shout-out to Ozzy, and he listed some of his songs, and he said, you know, your mother's favorite, you know, and I can't remember the song titles now. But, of course, you're assuming that Ozzy knew where he was that night. I'm not convinced.
Well, he jumped on the table, so maybe he didn't know where he was.
He did.
But the point is, President Bush was becoming one of the people in the room. You know, he was humanizing himself by making reference to someone no one would ever expect him to talk about. Presidents use that night, right?
Oh, sure. Well, I mean, you want to be funny, and so you play off what's in the crowd. John Stewart was not the John Stewart we know today. Most of the people in the room had no idea who he was. And he had his speechwriters, he said, give me some names that people in Washington know, and I'll just use them in my bit, and it'll be funny.
When in your lifetime do you think you'll ever get the opportunity to meet or even really eat in the same room as the Carl Lubsdorf? They told me that name would work. I really don't know who he is.
John Stewart just did that to play to the audience.
Crap. Yeah.
The two who have understood it the best, Al Franken understood the audience. He understood the people there.
He knew his crowd.
Right, right.
Andrea Mitchell was the only one with any spine at all. She actually threatened the president. She said if she didn't get an exclusive, that she'd see to it that short-term interest rates went up during the year.
And who was the other one?
The second was Seth Meyers. It was there in a tough year. It turned out later was the year that the president knew that he had ordered the mission that was going to kill
Osama bin Laden. But Seth Meyers was exactly like Al Franken. Both of them had been writers on Saturday Night Live. And
the Donald Trump jokes.
Pitch perfect. Knew who was in the audience, knew what was funny, didn't think of MSNBC audience. He thought of the people in the room.
It's a gift to know how to work a room.
Yep.
So what is the future of the White House Correspondents' Dinner?
I think it continues the way it is. I think the single comedian format is working. Comedians like doing it. As long as you have a president of the United States who will come, the dinner will continue.
Thank you, George Condon. For Washington Insider, I'm Tammy Haddad. Thanks for joining us. Please note our program is in no way affiliated with the White House Correspondents Association. Our views are our own. If you liked what you heard, be sure to subscribe to our podcast and keep an eye out for more episodes coming soon. Co-executive producer Julie Donofrio and Haddad Media. These programs are produced in conjunction with Simon Marks and the Feature Story News team, including Rob Flynn. Special thanks to Georgetown University Library, Library of Congress, National Archives, the National Park Service, the Franklin Delano Roosevelt Presidential Library and Museum, Harry S. Truman, Little White House, Jimmy Carter Presidential Library, John F. Kennedy Presidential Library and Museum, Ronald Reagan Presidential Library, the William J. Clinton Presidential Library and Museum, WhiteHouse.gov, White House Photos, and the White House Correspondents Association.